The narrative of 2 Samuel chapter 15 through 20, and I urge you to go ahead and track down that section of the Bible, 2 Samuel chapter 15, is really a series of chapters that provide us with court intrigue, with cunning insurrection, with the death of another crowned prince in Israel, and with civil war in the nation. And the size of this section that is devoted to the rebellion of Absalom. In fact, as we come to the fourth Sunday of the month, as we have done this year, to focus in on what we are reading through the year of the books of Samuel, we've spent really the entire month of November reading about, in one way or another, the rebellion of Absalom. And the length of this section shows us just how serious and how close David came to losing the throne. In chapter 15 that we looked at the end of October, we were told there that Absalom, through seditious means, was able to steal away the hearts of the people of Israel. It was really a masterpiece of strategy and diplomacy and public relations. And what it confirmed to us is that this prince, who is the next in line for the throne of Israel, was not simply gifted in the way of physical appearance, but that he possessed a natural charisma, a remarkable aspect of discernment, of great intellect, that he was very effective socially, and that he was a man of incredible patience, because in chapter 15 he implemented a plan that was at the very least 4 years in the making. That he had built a sizable base of support among the nation of Israel. And in chapter 15, he launched his campaign of insurrection against his father. We were also told in that chapter of how David fled from not just the palace, but from the capital. And during his long and sad procession from the city of Jerusalem, as the chapter closes, we're told of a list of friends that come to provide help to him. Ittai, a native of Gath, who had just recently joined David's troops and yet commits to staying among them. Two priests, Zadok and Abiathar, who are sent back into the city of Jerusalem for the purpose of providing David with intel about Absalom. And Hushai, a man who will be critical in terms of David's victory and his success. In that section, we're also told, however, about one foe. And his name is Ahithophel. He was a wise counselor who had already served in David's court, who apparently had grown discontent with David's reign, believed that David was no longer worthy of being king. And so he throws his support behind Absalom. And to have an advisor the level of Ahithophel would have given Absalom instant credibility in the minds of many in Israel. Beginning in chapter 16, just to sort of hit some of the highlights, we're only going to look at chapter 18 this morning, but just to hit some of the highlights to lead us up to that. We find in the first four verses, Jesus, as he passes the summit of the Mount of Olives, is met by Ziba, a man that we've already met in our readings. He was the one who was given the responsibility of the care and the cultivation of the estate of Mephibosheth. And he arrives at David as he flees from Jerusalem with a large supply of food and provisions that would enable David and his army to succeed. When David questions him about the absence of Mephibosheth, the king is told a story about Mephibosheth's decision to remain in Jerusalem because he saw an opportunity to perhaps regain some aspect of the kingdom for his family. He came from the family of Saul. And yet later in our readings, what we read this past week in chapter 19, we find that Mephibosheth, when he eventually meets David, when David is coming back into Jerusalem, that Mephibosheth tells a very different version of those events. And it seems that Ziba here in chapter 16 lies to David for the purpose of fulfilling his own personal cause or prosperity. In verses 5 through 14, we read of a man named Shimei, who is from Saul's home tribe of Benjamin, and he is very vocal in his demonstration of delight in David's downfall. He sees it as an act of divine judgment, and as David is fleeing from the city of Jerusalem, Shimei is pouring down insults and stones upon the fleeing monarch, and in typical fashion, Abishai, one of David's most loyal soldiers, offers to silence the detractor by slicing off his head. David, however, responds with faith and humility. David leaves the possibility that maybe God had sent Shimei, and therefore David is in no position to argue with Shimei or to stop Shimei's tongue. David simply chooses to leave the matter in the hands of God. In verses 15 through 19, we're told there of Absalom's arrival in the city of Jerusalem. And he is met by Hushai, who pledges his loyalty and his allegiance, though, of course, he is actually there to help David. He says, "Long live the king." He just never specified which king he actually had in mind. But he is able to win Absalom's trust. And as a result of that, is going to play an essential role in David regaining the kingdom. As the chapter closes, we're told of the first piece, at least of recorded advice, that Ahithophel gives to Absalom, and that is to go into David's concubines. It would be an act that would assert his status as the newly proclaimed king. It would demonstrate that he was the one who had now taken over, and that there would be no turning back at this point in time. In chapter 17, we're told of Ahithophel's second piece of counsel to Absalom. While his first piece was not only immoral but illegal under Mosaic law, his second piece of advice is practical, and it's incredibly shrewd. Ahithophel tells Absalom, David has gotten the wind knocked out of him. Absalom's surprise revolt has caught David off guard. And therefore, Ahithophel says, the time to strike is now. He wisely urges Absalom to allow him, that is Ahithophel, to take 12,000 troops who are already assembled and to move quickly and to hunt down the vulnerable David. He understood that at this moment in time, David's troops are exhausted and disorganized and therefore unprepared for battle. And so an all-out assault would speedily end in the death of David and would remove virtually any opposition to Absalom becoming king. In verses 5 through 14 comes a critical section in the narrative, and that is that David's friend Hushai now enters the scene. And he provides Absalom with very different counsel from Ahithophel. Ahithophel's advice was, strike while the iron is hot. Hushai's advice is, Absalom, you better look before you leap. Hushai's alternate plan must not only sound like it has a better chance of succeeding, but it must be strong enough to not just persuade Absalom, but to persuade the majority of men who are around Absalom. And so this plan is very well thought out. It appeals to Absalom's vanity. And Hushai advises that Absalom, if he moves too quickly, might allow David to actually gain an upper hand. That if David starts to win in the battle, that panic could spread among Absalom's troops, leading to defeat, because after all, David is an experienced warrior. He's familiar with guerrilla tactics, and therefore caution needed to be exercised. That if victory is to be attained, Absalom needed to take the time to gather a massive fighting force from all over Israel that would be able to hunt down and to crush David no matter where he tried to hide. And then the appeal to Absalom's pride is that rather than allowing Ahithophel to go and lead the troops, Absalom, you need to be the one leading in the attack. Because if you lead in the attack, failure will be impossible. We're told in verse 14 of chapter 17 that it is with the help of God that Hushai's proposal wins the day, and that Ahithophel's counsel is thwarted. But the reality is that Hushai, all he's actually done is bought David some time. He has to get word to David in regard to the steps that David now needs to take. And so in chapter 17, verses 15 through 23, it reads sort of like a spy novel, that Hushai supplies instructions to the two priests, Zadok and Abiathar, who send word by way of a female servant to their sons, Ahimaaz and Jonathan, who have remained outside of the city of Jerusalem, so that they can then deliver word to David. But the plan is not carried out without some difficulty. Because the presence of those two sons of the priest is recognized by some unnamed lad in the text, and he responds by bringing word of that to Absalom, who sends his own servants out to do some investigation. But due to the efforts of a shrewd woman in Bahurim, she is able to divert those who were sent by Absalom. And as a result, the urgent information is then brought to David. And the information is this: David, do not remain at the fords of the Jordan. You cross the river. And this was an extremely important piece of advice, because there were limited ways across the Jordan River. And if you can imagine what the parking lot is like after a big sporting event or a concert, there's only so many ways out of the parking lot. And there was only so many ways of crossing the Jordan River. And if you are under attack while you are trying to cross the river and find those very few places where crossing would be made easy, chaos is going to be the result, and defeat of David's troops is almost certain. And so even though it took a great deal of effort, that is, they worked all night, David is finally able to put the Jordan River between him and his company and the troops of Absalom. But this now swings the strategic advantage quickly in David's favor. In chapter 17, verses 24 through 29, we find the final stages being set to determine who is ultimately going to be king in Israel. It's going to take one battle fought on one day to determine who reigns over Jerusalem. The text tells us that David arrives at Mahanaim, a fortified city. And from there, David is going to be able to organize his troops, to formulate a strategy. We're told that Absalom also crosses the Jordan River, that he has Amasa, who is his new general. And they camp in Gilead. And as the chapter 17 closes, we find word of more allies of David's who arrive from various locations and bring much needed supplies for he and his troops. All of that leads us up to chapter 18. And it's here that we find the defeat of the rival in the form of Absalom. There are four parts to the chapter. Part one involves a strategy that's formulated. Let's begin our reading here in chapter 18 and verse 1. Then David numbered the people who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. David sent the people out, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai, the Gittite. And the king said to the people, "I myself will surely go out with you also." But the people said, "You should not go out. For if we indeed flee, they will not care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, now it is better that you be ready to help us from the city." Then the king said to them, "Whatever seems best to you, I will do." So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and thousands. The king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. David's strategy is he takes his troops and he divides them into three companies. One each under the leadership of a different individual. David initially makes plans to join the troops himself, but he is persuaded not to. His men understand what Ahithophel understood, and that is that if Absalom's troops can somehow kill David, the battle really is over. And the way is paved with gold for Absalom to ascend over the nation of Israel. That David's presence on the battlefield becomes more of a liability than it does an asset. That their effort to protect David, they could actually find themselves distracted and at greater risk. And so David wisely agrees to support the campaign from within the city. Now you remember that Ahithophel's counsel to Absalom was for Ahithophel to go out and to lead the troops. Hushai's advice included the fact that, "Absalom, you need to be the one who leads the troops." And Hushai's advice is going to make Absalom vulnerable. If Absalom is killed, the same thing is also true, that his followers are now left without motivation and victory is much easier for David. David appears rather confident that his troops are going to prevail, that Absalom's defeat is inevitable, and yet before his troops depart, David publicly pleads with his generals to deal gently with his son. And that was instruction that makes perfect sense as a parent. It makes absolutely no sense as a king. This is not some minor family disagreement that can be settled with a hug and an apology. Absalom has shown himself to be a cunning traitor. And therefore, if Absalom should survive, there would always be the threat of opposition, of Absalom's opposition hovering over David's kingdom. In verses 6 through 8, we find a battle that's fought. Then the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. The people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter there that day was great, 20,000 men. For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. The account of the entire battle takes just 3 verses. And even though it seems that Absalom's troops have a numerical advantage, there are a couple of things that tip the odds in David's favor. First of all, is experience versus inexperience. David's men are battle-tested warriors. They are under the leadership of skilled generals. Absalom's men, on the other hand, at the very best, are part-time militiamen who have been called together in a rather short period of time. The second advantage for David is in terms of the terrain. It's been said that he who chooses the battlefield usually wins the war. We're not told whether or not David specifically chose the venue, but it's certainly not out of the question. It is to be done in the forest of Ephraim. Now, this isn't a forest like we typically think of it. It was a rather rugged area with trees, a lot of underbrush, and apparently a host of other dangers that result in the fact that the environment actually kills more of Absalom's soldiers than do the swords and the arrows of David's troops. It was a situation, a condition in which Absalom's troops, rather than fighting as one massive force against David's troops and therefore overwhelming them, are actually end up separated from one another. And therefore, it seems that what's taking place here is a lot of much smaller battles in much closer quarters. And David's warriors, much versed in guerrilla warfare, make quick work of Absalom's untrained army to the extent that 20,000 men in Absalom's army die. Now, it's clear from what follows in verse 9 that the writer is not emphasizing to us the details of David's military victory. What he's focusing on is the specifics of Absalom's death, and in particular, its impact on David. And so that leads us to the third aspect of the story, and that is a rebel that is suspended. Verse 9. Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of the great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him kept going. When a certain man saw it, he told Joab and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." Then Joab said to the man who had told him, "Now behold, you saw him. Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? And I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." The man said to Joab, "Even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, 'Protect for me the young man Absalom.' Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof." And Joab said, "I will not waste time with you here." So he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And the 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained the people. They took Absalom and cast him into a deep pit in the forest and erected over him a very great heap of stones, and all Israel fled, each to his tent. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself a pillar which is in the king's valley, for he said, "I have no son to preserve my name." So he named the pillar after his own name, and he called it Absalom's monument to this day. Now, because it's not our culture, we may miss the imagery that is seen here. Mules were the typical means of transportation for princes and kings. And therefore, when Absalom loses his mule in a rather humorous way, this symbolizes him losing his kingdom. And it's very likely that there's other imagery that's going on here as well, that he is suspended between two realms, that his rebellion has left him with no solid ground under his feet, and yet he has no strength to climb up actually any higher into the tree and escape. He's suspended, in a sense, between life and death, between judgment on a rebel and value of being a son, between the severity of an angry monarch and the yearning of a loving father. And what's a bit humorous here is that David's men really don't have to hunt him down. His own pride has left him helplessly suspended in the midst of a tree. It's not specifically told to us that he got his hair caught. He would typically cut his hair once a year. And it seems that he's let his hair grow so that everybody could see who he was. And it's worked against him. His own pride brings about his downfall. He's the arrogant aristocrat who insisted on driving his limousine out into the battlefield where the terrain simply was unsuitable. He wanted to be recognized that he was the king, the new king, Absalom. And David's pre-battle instructions were all focused on his welfare. The first man who finds him follows that instruction. He refuses to lift his hand against the king's son, and yet Joab, as we'll see, has no qualms in doing so. Joab, first of all, derides the man who initially discovered the rebel, and the man is very smart, very wise. He understands, look, if I kill him, that ain't going to stay a secret for very long. David is going to find out about it. Joab, you could offer me 1,000 pieces of silver. I know that in the end, when the king finds out about it, you're going to leave me holding the bag. And so he refused to lift his hand. Joab, however, puts him to death. Now, what we've read of Joab in our reading through Samuel, sometimes you're sort of bothered by him, aren't you? I mean, he takes a very brutal approach to things. He oftentimes implements rather unsavory tactics. But there is one thing that is emphasized throughout all of the writings, and that is that Joab is not doing this because he wants the throne. Joab does what he does because he is incredibly loyal to David. And Joab understands, look, if we bring Absalom back alive, David is not going to pronounce the appropriate sentence, no matter how much it was deserved or how much the law called for it. Joab does his calculations, and what he concludes is that David's displeasure with me is going to cause a lot less problems and a lot less harm to Israel, a lot less difficulty in the continuation of David's kingdom, than if I allow Absalom to stay alive and perhaps to continue his opposition against David. And so Joab takes 3 spears, thrusts them into Absalom's heart as he remains suspended in the oak tree. His armor bearers join in, 10 of them. And it seems that they're doing that not so much to ensure death, but to cloud any one individual as being responsible. With Absalom dead, the battle is essentially over. And so Joab restrains any further pursuit. We're told about Absalom's burial that as much as potential as Absalom had, as great as his abilities were, he's remembered simply by a pile of rocks and a monument that he had built to himself. The chapter ends with a message being delivered to David, verse 19. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, "Please let me run and bring the king news that the Lord has freed him from the hand of his enemies." But Joab said to him, "You are not the man to carry news this day, but you shall carry news another day. However, you shall carry no news today because the king's son is dead." Then Joab said to the Cushite, "Go, tell the king what you have seen." So the Cushite bowed to Joab and ran. Now Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said once more to Joab, "But whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite." And Joab said, "Why would you run, my son, since you have no reward for going?" "But whatever happens," he said, "I will run." So he said to him, "Run." Then Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain and passed by the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up on the roof of the gate by the wall. And he raised his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was running by himself. The watchman called and told the king. And the king said, "If he is by himself, there is good news in his mouth." And he came nearer and nearer.
Then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, "Behold, another man is running by himself." And the king said, "This one is also bringing good news." The watchman said, "I think the running of the first one is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." And the king said, "This is a good man and comes with good news." Ahimaaz called and said to the king, "All is well." And he prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. And he said, "Blessed is the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who lifted up their hands against my lord the king." The king said, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent the king's servant and your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was." Then the king said, "Turn aside and stand here." So he turned aside and stood still. Behold, the Cushite arrived. And the Cushite said, "Let the lord the king receive good news, for the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you." Then the king said to the Cushite, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And the Cushite answered, "Let the enemies of the Lord my king, all and all who rise up against you for evil, be as that young man." The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And thus he said as he walked, "O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son." The son of Zadok initially wants to carry word of victory to David. Joab, however, is very wise. He denies the request. He chooses to send a Cushite, a foreigner, to deliver the news instead. We're not specifically told what Joab's motive is here, but it's very likely that he remembered David's response to what other people said was good news. That when the messenger came telling David about the death of Saul, when the messenger came and told David about the death of Ishbosheth, that David put those messengers to death. And so that may be why Joab sends this Cushite instead. But Ahimaaz won't be denied. He presses for permission, and even though the Cushite has been given a head start, he passes the Cushite by, and he is the first guy to arrive at David, who is stationed between the two gates, between the outer wall and the inner wall of the city. Watchmen are continually on the lookout. And Ahimaaz, as he arrives, he must have been thinking while he was running, you know what, this might not be good for me to tell David that his son is dead. And so he deflects the question. The Cushite arrives, and he delivers the good news, bad news scenario. And even he avoids mentioning the specific name Absalom. Now, we might have expected a mixed response on the part of David. Joy that he is victorious and his kingdom will be retained, and yet sadness over the death of his son. But what the writer points us to is the fact that David demonstrates only grief and sorrow at the loss of his son. That for whatever reason behind his sorrow, it is going to prove so severe that it will actually begin to undermine his influence in the nation of Israel. That though thousands of other men have died in the battle, David's powerful sense of loss, you'll notice that he mentions that phrase, "my son," 5 times in a single verse. He'll do it 3 times in chapter 19 and verse 4. Seems to turn this marvelous military achievement and the preservation of his kingdom into almost what seemed to David to be a defeat. 3 points of application, then we'll wrap up this morning. The first one, we passed over it fairly quickly, but notice, if you will, chapter 18, verses 17 and 18, because there we see the foolishness of trying to make a name. The body of Absalom is buried under a pile of rocks that within a few years will be unidentifiable. The only thing that would remain was a monument that he had made to himself. It will be about the only remembrance that they would have in Israel. Back in chapter 14 of this same book, we were told that Absalom had 3 sons. And it seems apparent that by this point in time, those 3 sons are dead. And so here is a man who is trying to become king, and yet he doesn't even have the simple blessing that some of the most common people in Israel would have had. And that is somebody to carry on their name. His action here is very reminiscent of those in Genesis chapter 11 who look to build a tower and make a name for themselves, to be remembered long after they're gone, to in a way outlive their life, but to do it without God. And that was Absalom's approach here. And the lesson that we learn is that rather than trying to make a name for ourselves, rather than building monuments to ourselves, that we are much better served by leaving behind a spiritual legacy, by trusting in God to make a name for us. That was the very thing that God told Abram back in Genesis chapter 12. I will make your name great. Do we understand that whatever you might achieve in the business world, whatever you might achieve in terms of your status with your vocation, do you understand that success without succession is failure? That passing on our faith to our kids is of much greater significance in making a name for ourselves than who we are or the things that we've done in life. Secondly, we find the paralyzing potential of grief. When Absalom is dead, the people perceive it to be a situation of God delivering David, of allowing the rightful king to take his place on the throne. And yet David, on the other hand, becomes so absorbed in his sorrow that he forgets about the people that are still alive. Again, we've seen Joab be this ruthless man who operates at times by his own agenda, but in the first part of chapter 19, he is going to have it right. He's going to go to David and he's going to say to David, look, these men risked their lives to be loyal to you, and you have made them feel ashamed. They're convinced that if all of them had died on the battlefield and Absalom lived, that you'd be happy with that. Joab was willing to say the hard things, to speak the truth in love to David, to emphasize to David, look, you're still the king. You have a job to do. You have a role to fulfill. And if you keep going the way that you're going, Absalom didn't defeat you, but you're going to defeat yourself. And to David's credit, David listened to the counsel of Joab. And then third, and perhaps the most important lesson, not just in this chapter, but really in all of the books of Samuel. In fact, we've called our readings this year, Seeing God at Work. And that is what's been emphasized through both 1 and 2 Samuel, and especially here in this chapter, is that God uses people to bring about His purposes. He uses individuals just like you and me, that rather than giving us all of the details of David's military strategy or the specifics of what you and I might deem to be a really important event, the writer chooses far more frequently to simply show us God's hand at work in the lives of different people. You see, when you think about from 2 Samuel chapter 15 to here where we close in chapter 18, think of all of the individuals that have played a role in David's success, his retention of the kingdom. We're told about David and Absalom. We're told about Ittai and Zadok, Abiathar, Ahimaaz, Jonathan, Hushai, Ziba, Shimei, Abishai, Ahithophel. We didn't talk about Shobi and Barzillai. But all of them played a role in the narrative to bring about God's ultimate purpose of David retaining the monarchy. In fact, that number of people even includes a couple of folks who aren't named for us, that seem to be just insignificant players on the stage, and yet they play crucial roles in bringing about the defeat of this rival. The maidservant, not named for us, who carries word from the two priests, Zadok and Abiathar, to their sons, Jonathan and Ahimaaz. What an important role, and yet she's never named for us. The role of the woman in chapter 17, who when they came to Baharim, who hides them and points Absalom's servants in a different direction so that those two men are eventually able to come to David and to communicate what Hushai, the counsel that Hushai has given. But one of the most important reminders in this chapter is that God doesn't just work in the lives of people in the past. It's intended to emphasize to us that God continues to work in and through the lives of His people still today. Now, it may not be all written down for us in an inspired text, but it's here. That's what we're being shown, is that God works in the lives of His people to accomplish His purposes and His will, and that's as true now as it was then. Are you a willing participant in that? If you're an unbeliever this morning, if you've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, I understand God's still going to use you. He used Ahithophel. He used Absalom. They were unwilling, participants. But God used them to accomplish His purposes. And He can use you as well. But you're much better served if you're a willing participant. If you're striving in your life, as we talked about this morning in our class in 1 Peter, to be a participant in bringing about the purpose of God in this world. If you need to obey the gospel of Jesus this morning, to be born into His family, there is no better time than now. Don't put it off another moment. Look to walk with Him to fulfill His purpose in your life. If we can help you to do that, no better time. Come right now while together we stand and sing.